Our babies, and welcome to another episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I am one of your hosts, Allison with an I, joined today and always by my co-host, Allison with a Y.
Hello.
And Patrick.
Hey.
Today was my pick. I chose a movie with a really obnoxiously long title. I am the pretty thing that lives in the house. This is the second film written and directed by Osgood Perkins, who is now best known for Long Legs. It follows a nurse named Lily, played by Ruth Wilson, as she moves into the home of her new client, a retired horror writer named Iris, played by Paula Prentice. Lily almost immediately begins to notice signs of unusual goings-on in the house, most notably a rapidly growing spot of black mold on a single wall. Iris refers to Lily only as Polly, which prompts Lily to begin reading one of Iris's books featuring a character by that name. As Lily reads Polly's story, the lines between fiction, reality, and the supernatural become increasingly blurred.
This is a fun one to write a synopsis for.
Yeah. I don't know why I picked this movie. I think that the title was intriguing. I could not remember if I had seen it in typical me fashion, and it was an hour and 30 minutes, which is the perfect length for a movie. Beyond that, I have no real conviction behind why I chose this movie, but you two had seen it before, hadn't you?
Yes.
Which, didn't you forget that we had seen it?
No, I knew that I had seen it.
Oh, you forgot that we had seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, I still am not convinced that we saw it together.
Yeah.
Wait, I thought you said you saw this. This was the first horror movie that you guys watched together. Or am I
don't think it was. I actually think that was Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I don't know if it was the first one we watched together, but it was very early.
I don't know where I got that from.
I mean, I just said it was early. That's probably where you got it from. It was definitely among the first movies we watched together. But yeah, I had seen it before too and didn't have much of a memory of it, which says, I don't know, whatever. I forget a lot, but I still feel like that says some things about the movie right up front.
I remembered a lot of the visuals, but I didn't remember a lot of what happened. Mm-hmm. And I guess that makes sense after the rewatch.
Yeah.
I remembered very few of the visuals other than like the, I guess, sort of signature visual of the movie that appears on the poster, which is, you know, this blurry kind of motion delayed image of a woman walking backwards.
Yeah.
Like I remembered that, but I think that was really it.
Right. That part. I think I did that thing where like halfway through it, I was like, oh, okay, I think I've seen this. But then I assigned like a different ending to it. And then by the time I got to the actual ending, I was like, I don't know if I've seen this.
Mm-hmm.
It felt weirdly familiar, but I couldn't have told you what happened. And spoiler alert, not a lot happened.
Yep.
Yeah. I want to talk about the director, Oz Perkins. I didn't realize that Oz Perkins is Anthony Perkins' son.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I had no idea.
And Elvis Perkins's brother for the music nerds.
I have no idea who that is.
He was a big deal in like the heyday of like mid-aughts indie music. And he's done music for, I think maybe most, if not all of his brother's movies. Mm. He did the music for this, which is good. I mean, I appreciate him a lot as a musician, and I think he brought a lot to the soundtrack. But yeah, talented family. Let's put it that way.
And the funny thing is, when I looked him up, when I was like, oh, my God, he's directed several pretty iconic, well, at least a couple of very iconic ones at this point, horror movies, you know, more recently with Long Legs and with The Monkey. But I knew him from Legally Blonde,
because
he was an actor in Legally Blonde.
Wait, I have to look at his picture.
Interesting.
I immediately, I saw him and I recognized him. I'm like, what do I know him from? And he's just like played like this nerdy, socially awkward character and Legally Blonde. And I would have never guessed that he would end up being a director and that he was the son of Anthony Perkins, which also explains why a clip from one of Anthony Perkins' movies was shown during the film. In this movie.
Oh, the only thing they ever managed to watch on TV.
Yeah. Yeah, it had Anthony Perkins in it, which I immediately recognized and didn't know that Oz Perkins was his son.
I did not know in general. I mean, now that I'm looking him up in real time, which could have done this before we did the episode, but I did not know that he has done a decent amount of acting in general. He's in Nope. He's the commercial director at the beginning of Nope.
Oh, wow.
He was in J.J. Abrams' Star Trek, and he played the young version of Norman Bates in Psycho 2.
I did see that, yeah.
Wild. Wild. Well, anyways, yeah, like, how do we feel about him as a director otherwise? Like, what kind of feelings about him did we bring into this movie? I'm a little mixed on him in general. He's made some stuff I fucking love, like The Monkey, and some stuff that I feel lukewarm about, like Black Coat's Daughter, and you know, I wasn't 100% in on Long Legs either.
Oh, I loved Long Legs. I am a total slut for Nick Cage.
Excellent.
Oh, I mean, same.
Yeah,
there was a lot I did like about that movie. I think I just when you draw that much attention to your movie being that much like The Silence of the Lambs. I love The Silence of the Lambs, and you better fucking deliver. And yeah, exactly. And I mean, it came fairly correct. It's like, if you're going to be that much like The Silence of the Lambs, you better try and one-up one of the greatest movies of all time.
Who compared it to Silence of the Lambs? Like the viewers? Fans?
No, I just think it's like fairly clear the, you know, like, you know, young female trainee, you know, going to solve a case with the help of, you know, reclusive serial killer who isn't actually in the movie that much.
Yeah, that's fair. I really liked Long Legs. I liked, you know, again, they did oversell it. It was the scariest movie of 2024. And it's like, stop doing that.
Movie had great marketing. Did you see the ad for that where they had what was supposedly like a recording of Micah Monroe's heartbeat the first time that she saw Nick Cage in costume as Long Legs? Like, ridiculous. There's no way that was real, but great marketing.
Yeah. And she's so great too. I loved Long Legs. Oh, yeah. I walked out of there being like, fuck yes. I saw The Monkey on the flight back from Italy. I think we talked about that in one of our horror catch-ups. Loved that one.
Mm-hmm.
This was very different than those.
Yeah, I mean, he's just a very vibey director. And I think, interestingly, his career has kind of leaned away from the movies where he's just doing vibes. Because Black Coat's Daughter is pretty similar to this, where it feels a little, like, plotless and a little abstract and yeah, just it's vibes more than anything, and this certainly is too. And then Long Legs feels a lot more conventional than either of those, and then The Monkey is just a ridiculous fucking movie that feels completely different, really, almost from anything that he's done. But yeah, I mean, it's a vibes movie.
I wonder if, like, earlier in his directing career, if he kind of like felt this sort of need to live up to the legacy of Psycho at all. You know, since that is, I mean, that is, as we all know, a phenomenal film, but it's also pretty vibey. You know, there's a lot more that happens, obviously. But I wonder if there was like that kind of pull to kind of like live up to this sort of, what's the word?
Legacy.
Yeah. Yeah. Live up to that kind of legacy with it, but.
Possibly.
The only other thing that I had seen of his outside of this was, I think I watched The Black Coat's Daughter with you, Patrick, when you watched it for the show. And I didn't hate it, but I it also didn't make a ton of sense to me. So I guess, like, since those are the only really two reference points that I have, other than him being an actor, I'm like, oh, I guess this makes sense. And then I found out that he did Long Legs and The Monkey, two movies that I haven't seen, but I from my knowledge, very different. It was surprising. So, I mean, hopefully these days he's having a little bit more fun and just kind of like doing things, doing films that bring him maybe a little bit more joy.
Yeah. And I haven't really, you know, I haven't read any interviews with him. I don't really have any insight into his psyche, which is, again, kind of ignorance on my part. But it does, I don't know, it does feel like he's having more fun, I guess, these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, the monkey just feels like someone having fucking fun making a batshit movie.
Mm-hmm. I took to Reddit to read about this, as one does, as I do. And saw, first of all, Black Coat's Daughter, a lot of people that were familiar with Oz Perkins, more familiar than I am, were like, oh, Black Coat's Daughter was better. So I haven't seen that. I can't attest or not attest to that. But somebody brought up a movie that this reminded them of, that it reminded me of too. And I felt validated in that. And it wasn't the same. They weren't comparing it plot-wise, but tonally, I think. And that was Skinamarink, which...
Yes.
I just did not. I think I reviewed Skinamarink on as a guest on an Amon episode a long time ago.
Yeah, because there was you were part of like Team Fuck Skinamarink. I think
dude,
there was
fuck
like
that movie.
That was a hashtag.
Fuck that movie.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Why? Yeah,
I was not a fan.
This was too pretentious and slow and art house. And all the and I think Stephen loved it. Chris loved it. I can't remember. Somebody there loved it. I did not. I felt very much watching this like I felt watching Skinamarink. I won't say the two movies felt the same, but I was very much like, what are we doing?
That's so funny that you brought that up, because there was literally a shot where I was having PTSD from watching Skinamarink. It was like a shot, I think at the beginning, where there's like clearly just a light like shining, kind of like a almost like a flashlight shining and looking around a room, and like in my head I was like, oh shit, this is very Skinamarink. And yeah, the rest of the movie wasn't
watching children sleep.
Yes.
So yeah, that makes sense.
And obviously, yeah, the rest of the movie didn't have that perspective, but a vibes movie more than a plot movie. Although I have to say, this one felt like it had more plot than Skinamarink.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, like, me eating dinner tonight had more fucking plot than Skinamarink.
Yeah. Somebody else on Reddit was like, this feels like a final project for, like, a film class that was supposed to be 90 minutes, but it was a 30-minute film. So they just, like, put a bunch of shit on repeat for the next 60. And I was like,
I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it looks great. Like, every shot is composed beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the narrative is kind of lacking here. And I mean, it's odd because the narrative has intriguing elements to it. You know, this setup of this nurse who clearly is like more than a little off herself,
yeah,
going to live with this, you know, old horror writer who's experiencing dementia is a cool premise. You know, this concept of a novel that may not be so much a novel as an actual account of a real life event, all pretty interesting. And even this, you know, sense of, you know, fiction, reality, ghost world, whatever, all kind of starting to blur in various ways, all pretty interesting. It just doesn't go much of anywhere. I mean, the weird thing too is like, I can't actually say that I was bored, because it almost sounds boring, but like, by the time something like actually really happens, I had to go to the bathroom and I paused it, and I think there were like 7 minutes left in the movie.
Yeah.
And then it's just, that's it. And I mean, you know, we'll talk about exactly what that is in the spoiler room, but I don't know. It's kind of uniquely frustrating, because there is some really interesting potential there. It just all kind of builds incredibly slowly and then just kind of farts out.
Yeah.
I was bored. I'll say I was bored. I was bored.
Mm. Yeah, I also wasn't bored. I was pretty, like, invested.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it just doesn't necessarily deliver on all of the atmosphere and the tension that it builds up. There's a lot of intriguing things, little pieces that are placed throughout the movie that don't really aren't ever fully realized.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it to be a little more tightly written.
Yeah. If you're going to give me like hospice nurse in a haunted house, I want like Skeleton Key. Have you guys seen Skeleton Key?
Yes.
First of all, love that movie.
I was so actually thinking about Skeleton Key too while watching this.
Our
minds were just like synced up on this one.
It's an Allison thing.
It is.
But give me something. Give me some kind of action. I just was like, we've already heard this line. I understand that you're – one of the Redditors said that this was like a poem that was being read. And okay, that's cool. Love that. But don't read it over and over again. I don't know. Right. Are you just repeating the poem from the top? Like,
right. Or make that more obvious.
Oh, right. Yes. And I really liked – Iris. I really liked Lily. She was a really quirky, weird, eccentric. I kept being like, what year is this supposed to be? Is this supposed to be the 60s, the 50s? I was like, why doesn't she have a cell phone when she's using the landline?
I was love that also it felt timeless.
Timeless, or I guess that's a word for it. Like ambiguous. Yeah.
You can't really pin it.
But I felt so fucking bad for Iris, this woman who clearly has a brilliant mind. First of all, I would have been reading all her books. Like, there's nothing else to do in that goddamn house. It's raining every day. But Iris clearly has, like, a brilliant mind. And I'm just feeling like, engage her. Like, talk to her, you know? Like, this poor woman is living out her days as a ghost herself. Basically a shell of a person. And, I don't know. I'm like, this is kind of elder abuse. Like, do something with her. I don't know. I'm off on a tangent.
Yeah. I mean, Lily was a scaredy cat. She didn't like horror books and also seemed to approach Iris with some contempt from square one, almost.
Yeah.
Which may have been informed by Mr. Wax Cap, which is a fucking insane name. The guy who, like, what even was his role? Like, what was his relation to Iris? I don't even know.
I could not figure that out.
I think he was, but like, he worked for the estate, right? So he was a lawyer. So like
solicitor.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And played by the great Bob Balaban.
Bob Balaban.
We should know.
Bless.
God bless him.
Bob Balaban always playing Bob Balaban.
Yeah. Right. Totally.
But he definitely introduces the idea that, like, Iris is considered a trash novelist, basically, you know, a very disposable, a writer of disposable paperbacks. And I think that informs some of the way Lily treats her. But Lily is also just off.
She is.
In ways that are hard to describe because we never quite understand why she is the way she is. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's so interesting because this actor, Ruth Wilson, who plays her, I think does an incredible job of calibrating the performance in a very weird way that feels like she has a good concept of Lily's history and personality and why and how she is the way she is. It feels like she and Perkins did a lot of work on this character, but it's frustrating because, it's hard to put your finger on what this person's deal is.
We don't know anything about her.
Right. Yes.
The only insight we get into who she is, who is in her life, is that phone call that she makes, which who knows who she's talking to on the other end.
Mm-hmm. Or if there's anybody on the other end, ooh, frankly.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Like that like was an opportunity to develop some character, get us attached to her.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that like works on an atmospheric level, but doesn't quite add up as a whole thing, you know, like that performance works really well as far as just being very disorienting and creating a character that is compelling, but it just doesn't offer even rudimentary answers. And I don't need everything fucking explained to me, but there's just a lot where it's like, what's going on here and why? Mm-hmm. Give me a little. little something.
And I don't think it would have taken much to get us a little bit more invested or give us a little more insight. It would not have taken much. Yeah. It just felt like it was atmospheric at the expense of everything else.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said a minute ago, about this being, you know, like a poem, because there is a lot of voiceover narration in this and a lot of, you know, so yeah, sort of poetic lines in that voiceover narration that are repeated and then return to, you know, this concept of being a pretty thing, and then the pretty thing that you're looking at is me is repeated by various characters in voiceover and in, you know, diegetic dialogue. And I don't know. What do y'all have any thoughts on what this movie's trying to do thematically? Because it's, you know, it's trying to do some stuff about, I guess, ghosts generally. It's definitely trying to do something about women and the treatment of women. But in my opinion, it's really flimsy and really half-baked.
My theory with what I think that they were trying to do with this film was, to me, the whole thing felt kind of like it was supposed to be an exercise in imagining up like a new Shirley Jackson story with Iris also being kind of a stand-in for Shirley Jackson, the author. And because
I think in the flashbacks, she even looks a lot like Shirley Jackson.
She does. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that, I think like the first time I saw the movie too, that's one of the things that I do remember. And, you know, her books, it looks like they resembled Shirley Jackson books as well. I feel like it was, yeah, an exercise in sort of recreating that thing that's more atmosphere and less anything fucking happening. A la, you know, or the Haunting of Hill House. That's what I think they were trying. Like, the more I think about this movie, that's what I think they tried to do. And it just fell short. Because I think the thing that worked, that made Hill House so classic, is just like how the interpretations of it and what people were able to do with those characters based on what you learned about the characters in the novel. Right?
Yeah.
But like this, you don't really learn much about anybody. But that's what I think that they were trying to do with this.
You and many, many Redditors compared this to a Shirley Jackson work.
Really?
Yes. Okay. So very astute. I fucking had no idea. So I took to Reddit to think, read some smarter people's opinions on it. But my kind of takeaway was like these three women were all different archetypes. I think we have, and right, like there's a big emphasis around their beauty and the word rot and the concept that beauty is only skin deep. Beauty fades with age. The concept of aging, right? Like Polly was obviously very beautiful, and she was stuck in a time where, a very archaic time where, I don't know.
1800s, which I think we haven't even referenced yet. But yeah, her story is set like in the 1800s.
Right. So women had a very different role, you know, seen and not heard, subservient to their husbands, that kind of thing. We have Lily, who's very beautiful, physically very odd, but she's kind of reclused to this house to caretake Iris for an indefinite amount of time. She ends up being there way longer than I thought she would be. And and the word rot, right, keeps coming to her. She keeps hearing Polly talk about rot. So, like, that concept of rotting, you know, she's not getting outside. No one's witnessing her beauty or whatever. And then we have Iris, who, like, the few shots of her where she's got her hair all done, like, stunning. Absolutely. Yeah. As an older woman. Stunning also, like, stunning and so cute and hip as a writer. But then as an older woman, beautiful. Like, gorgeous. Yeah.
Very elegant looking.
But all three of these women are ghosts in a way, right? So it's like three archetypes, three different types of women, all sort of a ghost in their own right. Beyond that, I don't know what it was trying to say. That's as deep as I can get with that.
Yeah. I want to go back to the idea of making a Shirley Jackson Modern Shirley Jackson story, because so I mean you reacted negatively to Hill House when you read it. Why? It's been too long since I've read that. I don't have a strong memory of it. I remember
like
liking it.
Just like bored.
Yeah, it was desperately boring.
Yeah, I don't recall it being boring. But I guess my point is Shirley Jackson is known for making for her allegories. Like The Lottery is her most famous thing. Mm. And that gets in, gets out, makes a fucking point for sure, leaves an impression on the reader, and makes a pretty clear social allegory. We have always lived in the castle, not quite as allegorical as The Lottery, but again, a story that moves, is creepy, has something to say about society. So I don't know, from my point of view, if this was trying to make a new, you know, a modern take on like a Shirley Jackson story, it failed miserably. Because when I think of a Shirley Jackson story, I think of something that is not only atmospheric, but also does quite a lot plot-wise and has a fairly clear thesis as far as what it's saying.
I guess I can't speak for her other... I mean, I've read The Lottery, but that was a short story.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other like novel, full novel length, and it's still pretty short, all things considered, thing that I've read was Hill House. Mm-hmm. So I guess I can't speak for anything beyond that, but I don't know. So much of... And like I said, I even think Hill House is better because you actually at least get characters, mm-hmm. like interesting characters that you get to know well, and they are very clear in who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Even if like the purpose of the novel is a little bit, fuzzy at times. I don't think they succeeded
mm-hmm.
in necessarily creating a Shirley Jackson-esque thing. It just, that strikes me that that was the goal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tribute to her in some way.
In several ways, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It is just a genuinely weird movie. It is puzzling in kind of an intriguing way. Like, I think this is a failure, but it's kind of an interesting failure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's a weird one.
Yeah, I have complicated feelings about it.
Yeah, same.
Oh, I was just about to say we should review it, but I also want to throw out a little fun fact. We have not given kind of a legendary actor her flowers. Iris is played by Paula Prentice, who has been in a lot of awesome shit, but most notably starred in The Stepford Wives, like original Stepford Wives, and The Parallax View, which is one of the great paranoia thrillers of all time. She's a big deal, and I kind of thought she might be. I don't know, there's just something about her presence in this where I was like, this woman feels very kind of intentionally cast, and sure enough, she's a big deal. I just wouldn't have recognized her until I, you know, looked at her Wikipedia, but she's very good in this, and it's kind of a cool bit of casting.
She looked familiar to me, but I haven't seen any of the movies that she was in aside from this one, but I really loved her. She did a lot with just a little.
I was very impressed with her ability to very realistically portray like somebody who clearly has some form of dementia. You know, it felt very realistic as like as somebody who, when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time in nursing homes because my mm-hmm. mom worked in them. It felt very authentic to the point where I was like, there's no way they actually got somebody who like has dementia to play this role, right? Like, you know, like later, you know, like more advanced dementia, because it was so realistically done. I mean, the way she held her mouth, the way she was like perceiving things, the confusion, so spot on.
Iris was the only character, and granted there weren't many in this movie, but I wanted to spend more time with her. And obviously I have some bias mm-hmm. because she was like a horror writer, and she had an interesting will that she wanted to leave the house to another female writer for free mm-hmm. when she died. And I was like, that's fucking cool. She called it the House of Stories. I wanted to spend more time with her. And I think that says a lot about Paula Prentice's work with, again, very little script. She had, like, almost no dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
But she was the only one I really was like, I want to know more about you. You know? Yeah. If I had to pick, I guess.
Yeah. When you mentioned the use of the term House of Stories, it actually made me wish for a second that there were, like, follow-ups to this movie that feel a little clearer and more focused. Like, maybe other weird ways in which her supposedly fictional tales show up within her real-life house. And we learn more about her and more stories from her mind.
I guess.
I don't know. I almost want a franchise that's never going to happen.
Yeah, these would be cool as like episodes of a series, like 45-minute episodes.
Yeah.
But to drag this out for 90 minutes was not the vibe for me.
Yeah, like I needed this to either be a short film with what they were trying to do. You could have condensed it into a short film, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or really develop the story a lot more, because there was so much potential to develop this story.
Yep.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. 30-minute film school thesis that got padded out to an hour and a half is exactly the descriptor for this. Yeah. I think. But before we pad this discussion out way longer than it nice should segue. Be.
It's going to be longer than the whole movie, this conversation.
Yeah.
And a lot more exciting.
To be determined by the listeners.
Yeah, TBD.
Before that, I will encourage you to visit our website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com, where we've got every episode we've ever done and a link to our merch store where you can buy t-shirts and all kinds of other goodies with Every Horror Movie on Netflix art on them.
And then you can follow us on social media at Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube at Amoncast, Ehmoncast, or TikTok at Amon Podcast. You can also join our Discord. Find the link in the show notes. Come join our discussions about the horror films that we've been watching for the show, other things that you've been watching, show us cat pics, all the good stuff.
And leave us a review anywhere you listen to your podcasts. We appreciate it.
So should we review this bad motherfucker? I guess I just reversed that, didn't I? We usually review and then we do the spiel. But this week we're doing the spiel and now we're reviewing.
Keeping it exciting.
Allison with an I, you picked this. What's your rating?
I think I'm a screw it. Somebody, actually more than one person on Reddit was like, I put this movie in the background to fall asleep because the narrator's voice is just so calming. It's like, that's not really accomplishing a whole lot as a horror movie if you're putting it on to fall asleep as your comfort movie. Like, I have comfort horror movies, but I'm not putting them on to sleep. Like, it's white noise. I think I loved the artistry of it all. I really loved the one only maybe scary part was like the Victorian Gothic ghost lady walking backwards. I was like, okay, that's cool and spooky and beautiful. Aside from that, I was bored. I needed more substance. I needed more from these women. I needed to understand why we were hearing about this story. If it was a poem, I needed to hear a little bit more about that to be invested. I just felt like I was bored at an art museum or something.
Heard.
Yeah, it's a screw it for me, sadly. But you know, nice try, Oz Perkins. I've never made a movie, so you're doing better than I am. Patrick, view it, cue it, or screw it.
I'm gonna go cue it. But it's like low cue it. I don't know. It's like I said before, I think it's a failure, but it's an interesting failure. I did find it more or less compelling, despite its slowness and despite the frustrations of watching it. I don't know. There's impressive craft there. And especially just that, given that Oz Perkins has become, you know, a pretty significant and influential voice in horror filmmaking now. If you haven't seen it and you find his other movies interesting, you know, it's certainly worth a look. But yeah, it's also kind of messy, and while I can't bring myself to condemn it strongly enough to give it a screw it, I also can't find it in me to give it a whole lot more than that. Allison with a Y.
I'm also a cue it. I recognize and fully own the flaws of this film. However, I really enjoyed It, like, for me, it was such a vibe. It kind of fits an aesthetic that I really love. I love the slow pace. I love just like a kind of spooky atmospheric movie. And it's a cue with a very strong warning of if you're looking for something with a lot of substance, this is not it. But I think it's a good movie to put on if you just like are having a really chill night. Put, you know, light some candles.
Take a gummy.
Get, you know, pop yourself some popcorn. Put it on. It's a vibe, and it's not going to be, you know, for some folks who maybe have tastes more aligned with mine, it's not going to be a total waste of your time. Just
sure.
Just don't expect there to be much.
Yeah, just let the vibe wash over you and yeah. Don't expect a whole lot more than the vibe washing over you.
And the vibes are great.
The vibes are great.
The vibes are great. So great. A couple people on Reddit were like, if you just like really pay attention, just like really don't pick your phone up, just really pay attention. And I'm like, I didn't have my phone in my hand the entire time. I paid attention. I think I got what there was to get out of this. And it wasn't a whole lot for me. Yeah. You know, mine's not Screw It with Prejudice. I was thinking, I don't know who I would recommend this movie to. And I couldn't come up with anybody. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at that point it was a Screw It for me. But yeah, a beautiful, beautiful movie. Not saying a whole lot.
Yeah.
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 Where's the spoiler room?
I mean, we got to pry open the moldy, moldy wall boards and... excavate the spoiler wall cavity.
See in the spoiler moldy wall. All right, everybody, we are in the spoiler moldy hole in the wall. Not really rolling off the tongue. To spoil, I am the pretty thing that lives in the house, which also doesn't roll off the tongue. So quite apt of us. What is there to spoil, y'all?
Holly's the ghost in the house, first and foremost, who was murdered by her husband and boarded up in the wall where that the wall that, you know, surprise, keeps growing mold out of. And I think it's at least this was my interpretation. When Iris was younger in the house, she saw Polly's ghost and communicated with it and figured out Polly's story. And that was the inspiration for her most popular novel,
The Woman in the Wall.
There are also the notes that she discovers that, well, I should specify which she. There are also notes that Lily discovers written in this very spidery script, and they appear to be very old. And it was inconclusive to me whose they were, because I was like, is this Polly's account of what happened to her that Iris then adapted into a book, or is this Iris's handwritten notes or manuscript for her own book? How did you all read that?
I thought they were Iris's notes.
Yeah, that made the most sense. They were kind of like waterlogged and destroyed.
Yeah, they had been molded.
Okay, so. So, right. Not Polly's account, then.
Iris keeps asking Lily, who she calls Polly, like, where did you go? You turned your back on me. What are your thoughts about why Polly stopped communicating with Iris?
So my thought, and obviously this is just pure speculation. My thought is that after Iris got Polly's story out of her somehow, figured it out, then Polly no longer felt like she needed to interact with Iris.
Or maybe Iris's dementia started to set in.
That's what I was thinking.
Could be, yeah.
Okay. You
know, that maybe she, yeah, hadn't seen anyone who appeared to be Polly for a while, and this new young woman shows up and something in her brain redraws that connection.
Absolutely. Yeah. That aligns with my theory as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she
hadn't
seen Polly in so long, and her brain reverted back to that time where she had.
And that's the thing, is we're purely theorizing. You know, there's not a ton
writing a better movie
textually to go on. Yeah, you can only draw your own conclusions about some of these things. Mm-hmm. A lot of these things.
Okay. But yeah. I read something on Reddit that I thought was really interesting, and I'm going to share it because I think you'll think it's interesting too. The Slow and Surreal soundtrack by Elvis Perkins, director Osgood Perkins' brother and also son of the late Tony Perkins, was based on the same folk song that inspired the script, Pretty Polly. This centuries-old folk song is sung in two halves. The first half is a man, Willie, begging his bride-to-be for one night of passion before their wedding day. Oh, pretty Polly, before we get married, some adventure to see. The second half is Polly fearing Willie will lead her astray, and that is exactly what happens. Having studied the folk song in many forms, it's my guess that Polly has slept with her groom before their wedding. Perhaps she's pregnant. Perhaps he's now repulsed by her now sullied character. Either way, he no longer intends to fulfill his promise of marriage. So that was cool to me because the whole premise is that Polly's husband built them this beautiful house by hand. Mm-hmm. And they enter the house, which we see Polly in a blindfold. And this is the story that is actually going around in town. So it's not necessarily folklore. It's like the history of what happened to this couple. Mm-hmm. Leads her into the house with a blindfold to show her this house that he built for them for their wedding the day after their wedding. And then no one ever sees them again. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much of this script or this story was inspired by this folk song, but I thought it was super interesting. But somebody else brought it up.
I feel like that aligns with sort of like its rough thesis about the ephemeral nature of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
That it's going to fade, and once it does, sometimes there will be people who just will get rid of you, like Polly's husband and Polly's fiance in the song.
Right.
Because, like, yeah, like maybe. Yeah, and once again, this is all speculation, but, you know, maybe part of like the whole reason why Polly's husband in the movie, you know, murders her is because, you know, he got what he wanted.
Right.
And doesn't want her anymore.
Right. And Iris keeps talking about how Polly can't remember how she died. Remember?
Yes. Yeah.
Like it happened so suddenly. She was blindfolded. She was led there under such false pretenses. There was like a total 180 shift between we're getting married. I built you this house and now you're dead. And you didn't even see it coming.
I think this maybe also, once again, I think we're drawing a lot of conclusions ourselves, but it maybe also is in line because like if she's dead, right? She is forever beautiful in his memory.
Ooh.
She is forever at that age. You know, obviously her corpse will decay, but like, you know, the memory of her is always young and beautiful and untarnished, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that's compelling. But yeah, again, there's just so little textually to go on that we're writing fanfic. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting fanfic.
Well, there were only two men in this movie. There were only three women. But I guess if we're not counting the like worker man that comes at the end, there were only two men in this movie. And they were both so, what was the lawyer's name?
Wax cap.
Was so dismissive and just like basically was looking through Lily, like she didn't exist. And she was such like a shrinking violet already, just like took up as little space as possible.
Looking through her like she was a ghost.
Like she was a ghost. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Again, like I do think this story, and another person said it, so I can't take credit for it, was really about like three ghosts, you know, in different forms. Mm-hmm. But the men were just, if those men were archetypes, if the women were archetypes, then the men were archetypes big mm-hmm. time, right? Like just dismissive and, I mean, murderous, obviously, not a good one.
Yeah, and I mean, it's to get to our final spoilers, by the end, they're all literal ghosts.
Right, right.
Iris, wait, actually, what does happen to Iris? How does Iris die?
She sees Polly's ghost, finally.
No, that's Lily. So I assume, okay, what I read happened, Lily gets scared to death, and then Iris probably is calling for Polly, wanting help.
Right.
She tries to get out of bed. It shows that she has fallen.
Yeah.
The bell is on the floor.
She's not in her bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where Iris died. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lily sees Polly's. I mean, this is the first time she actually sees Polly's ghost, even though Polly's ghost has clearly been, you know, making around. Its influence known. Yeah. But finally, Lily actually sees her. And I don't know. That was just silly to me that she immediately just like screams, presumably, I guess, has a heart attack and dies immediately, I guess, of fright.
I mean, she did say she was a scaredy cat. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a little, it's a little silly.
It is a little silly, but that scene where Polly's ghost is following Lily and it's pitch dark, and I'm like, turn on a fucking light, first of all. That's Allison with an eyes, horror movie, survive a horror movie scenario tip number two, second only to tip number one, which is put some goddamn shoes on. Not kidding. That's number one rule in my book. The terrifying, though, when Polly is following Lily around and she's walking back. That was creepy. I wanted more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then she, and this was the moment I was talking about where I paused it and then there were 7 minutes left in the movie. She sees her, screams, dies, and that's pretty much it.
And then 7 minutes of like nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
Falling action. Yeah. I mean, Iris dies, but that's pretty anticlimactic.
Yeah.
And then the saddest thing was that it took what's his nuts or anybody forever to find them, which was so fucking sad.
I
but
know.
Realistic.
But like also, I mean, is it realistic for like a live-in caregiver who I'm assuming, I mean, she was a hospice nurse. I'm assuming she had to check in with hospice. Like
right.
I assume she was working for a company or hospital or something. What are there not measures to check in on the wellness of these people?
Right.
Like that. But, you know, that's just me getting.
Which maybe that's part of the theme. Like these, all three of these women were discarded in a way or like forgotten in a way. I wouldn't say Polly was forgotten. Well, I guess she was. Nobody ever knew what happened to her.
Right.
So maybe that was the theme of like these women just being forgotten about by society and cast aside. I don't know. That to me was the saddest part as Lily's corpse is rotting and there's flies and she like sees the worker come to try to finally fix the fucking hole in the wall, which how much time has gone by then? Like, did she also, did she die of mold poisoning? Like, what?
Right. It's bizarre. And also, did the mold make her hallucinate Polly? I don't know.
Right. Did it do the same to Iris?
No answers.
I needed
lots of questions. What'd you say?
I said lots of questions, no answers.
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's, I mean, yeah, I mean, I've said this multiple times already, but there's just not a ton there in the text. Other than, you know, it's pretentious. I don't like using that word that much because I feel like it's overused and to the point where it doesn't mean anything, but this just is pretentious. There is a lot of pretense toward a certain idea, but it's just posturing, you know, it's just saying something that feels kind of smart, and there's just not a lot behind it, you know. I mean, certainly we can draw parallels between these three women, but I mean, the idea that it's communicating about them is fairly sophomoric, society has discarded these three women in various ways, and that's about all it really has to say about it. It's just, it's fundamentally kind of shallow. So yeah. Screw it.
See?
You changing your review?
Just kidding. I mean, I stick by what I said before. I mean, it's a frustrating fucking movie.
It is frustrating
movie. Mm-hmm. In such a unique way. Like, out of the many, many movies I've watched for this podcast and in general, it is frustrating in a really unique way because there both is and isn't a lot there. There's a lot, you know, like we said before about the vibes, there's a lot to just sort of let wash over you as far as the feeling and atmosphere of it all. And there's also just like nothing there, close to nothing there as far as the actual text and substance of what's going on, which, you know, I can enjoy a vibes movie, but it's a movie that faints in the direction of having something more than vibes going on, and it's just not there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there are movies that do so much and I wish no one would touch, like The Strangers. Like, I loved that movie when it came out. It scared the ever-living shit out of me. I am so annoyed that they had to make sequels to that. And I heard the latest one fucking sucked balls. Don't touch it. Just let it be alone. Like, leave it alone. And then there are movies like this where I'm like, do more. We need more of this. Like, I love what you're doing. I would have loved this movie because tonally, visually, beautiful. No substance. Touch it more.
Right. Like, rework this. You had such a cool idea with so much potential. Do it again. Do it again, but better.
Call Mike Flanagan. Like, get his notes.
Yeah.
Right.
Get some more character development. Get some more plot. I'm way down. But...
Make me cry a couple times, you know.
Yeah. Scare me.
Get Kate Siegel and Bruce Greenwood in there.
Heavy on Kate Siegel. We need her always.
Mm-hmm. This would have been a great role for Kate Siegel, actually.
Yeah,
which
I
is
was
not
just thinking that.
Not to knock Ruth Wilson's performance, but it would be a great Kate Siegel role.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know anyway. What else to say about it.
Yeah. It's,
yeah, I think that's enough.
Yeah.
Well, there we have it.
We're doing horror catch-up next episode, right?
Yay.
Yes.
Yay.
We are.
I have so much to talk about.
Oh, same. Yeah, it got kind of weirdly delayed because of our weird little recording schedule hiccup that we then inserted an extra episode into this month anyways, right after we said we were going to do less episodes. But yeah, we've got basically the entire month of spooky month to catch up on in mid-November, so mm-hmm. we're gonna have a lot to talk about next up.
Yes.
Maybe it'll be longer than I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House.
One more shout out for our social media, Allison with a Y. Where can you find us?
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube at Amoncast, E-H-M-O-N cast, and TikTok at Amon Podcast. You can also follow the link to our Discord server in the show notes to join our Discord server and tell us about your frustrations with this film as well.
There we have it, guys. It was great, great talking to you.
Well, see you next time.
For every horror movie on Netflix, I am Allison with an I.
Just like this movie, we have no idea how to end this episode. But I'm Patrick.
And I'm Allison with a Y.
Bye.